And so I think people are busy doing a lot of things they probably shouldn't be doing. And the reason is they're flailing around. This gets back to your question about purpose. People flail around because they don't really know what's more important than what.
Welcome to Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change. I'm your host, Ludvig Sundström, together with Mikael Syding. Today we talk to Professor Barry Schwartz about decision-making and psychology in a complex world. Barry is a professor of psychology who is currently serving as the visiting professor at the University of Berkeley, California. His many TED Talks have been viewed and listened to more than 20 million times, and they include The Paradox of Choice, Our Loss of Wisdom, Practical Knowledge, and Why the Way That We Think About Work is Broken. Barry has also written several popular books, where The Paradox of Choice is the best known one. In our discussion with Barry, we go over things such as when too much choice can be a bad thing, in which areas people prefer to have more choice, how Barry does his research and the process behind his books and TED Talks, what he did before he found his niche as a scientist and intellectual, and how long time it actually took him to do this. We also learn why we can't always trust what people say, and why Barry thinks social media should be controlled, and finally, why he thinks that soft skills and positive values will become more important as computers become better at displacing many of the existing jobs. We talk about, I would say, really a wide range of things, where the first half of the conversation is pretty deep, and then the second half, I would say, is a bit lighter. So let's listen to the conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as we did recording it. I'm Ludvig, and...
And I'm Michael. I'm not sure if you can hear the difference.
Yes, I can. Ludvig has a deeper voice.
Barry, thanks very much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Let's start a bit with your background. So I would be interested to know, what were you like as a kid? What motivated you back then?
Well, I was almost obsessed with athletics, with sports. I wasn't very good at them, but I read about them, I watched them, I somehow imagined that I would become a professional athlete, which was a delusion.
Did you know that you weren't that skilled at sports?
Quite skilled until I was about 10. And then what happened is that everyone I played against got bigger and faster and stronger, and I just got fatter. So it quickly became clear to me that my future was elsewhere. So I figured I would become a sports writer. I like to write. I was pretty good at it. So I thought I would be a sports writer, a journalist. And I never really gave it much more thought until high school, when I actually got interested in the world, aside from sports.
Do you see any clear connection between your childhood and your choices and your current and previous professions?
You know, I really don't. The world was really different. We're talking now about 50 years ago, more. I don't think people thought much about what their options were. You know, you just put one foot in front of the other and you saw what happened. So, I was a good student and I was an obedient person. So I did what my teachers asked me to do and I did well. And then, you know, there'd be a next class and I would do well again. And there wasn't a whole lot of reflection on what my future would hold. It wasn't really. And even when I started university, I happened to take a psychology course in my first semester of my first year of college. And it was taught by a truly inspiring teacher who became world famous as a psychologist and as a teacher of psychology. And I decided right then and there that I was going to study psychology. And I'd never even heard of psychology when I took this class.
And who was this person? Who was
his name? Is Philip Zimbardo, famous for the prison study.
Right.
At the time, he was teaching at New York University, which is where I was a student. He soon after left for Stanford, where he spent the rest of his career. So it was an accident. I took the class. It fit into my schedule, and it, you know, changed my life. And from then on, all I wanted to do was study psychology.
What do you think is a psychologist's role in society?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's become much more prominent than it was when I started, for a variety of reasons. One is that we have have come to take the study of psychopathology and psychopathological conditions much more seriously. It wasn't something, it is no longer something to be ashamed of or to hide. And so the expertise of psychologists who study, depression, anxiety, and things like that is now a significant contributor to society. In universities, you see students seeking help from counseling services and that help being provided generously, which is another acknowledgement that, many people have significant problems that that they need help to address. But in addition to that, what has become my field, the study of decision making, has loomed extremely large in the last 15 or 20 years as this field, which is mistakenly called behavioral economics, has come into existence. Behavioral economics is really psychology applied to economics, that's rarely appreciated. But Daniel Kahneman and his collaborator Amos Tversky revolutionized our understanding of decision making starting 30 odd years ago. Kahneman won a Nobel Prize for it, and that has become an extremely big influence on individual decision making, on how organizations make decisions, public policy. There's a book that had a big impact written by Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler called Nudge, about how societies can sort of gently induce people to make decisions that are actually in the people's best interest. And you see more and more national governments creating these little things they call colloquially nudge units.
Do you think that's a good thing?
I think that's a fantastic thing. I think people think that it's paternalistic and manipulative. It is manipulative and it is paternalistic. But the thing to appreciate is that there is no neutral way to present options to people. No matter how you present options to people, you'll be pushing them in one direction or another. So why not self-consciously push them in a direction that might actually lead them to live happier, healthier lives and have enough money saved up when they retire that they can have a decent retirement? So I think it's better to use the science to help people who are imperfect decision makers make better decisions than simply to pretend that the science doesn't exist. I mean, we're perfectly happy to let advertisers try to get us influence our decisions 10,000 times a day, not for our interests, but for their interests. So, and yet we get nervous when the state decides to try to influence our decisions to make us better off rather than it better off. So I think it's a great, terrific tool for helping societies to thrive and helping people to live more successful lives.
Right. I think that's a fascinating subject, but I would like to backtrack a little bit to your career. Before you really found your niche with decision making and made that sort of your specialty, before that, how long time would you say that you were, a professional psychologist, but you maybe hadn't quite found your niche yet? How long time did it take?
Oh, quite a long time. I started out studying the psychology of rewards and punishments in the tradition that was developed by a man named B.F. Skinner, who for many years was probably the most famous psychologist alive. And his view was that, everything that we do to avoid punishments or to gain rewards. And so if you engineer an environment that rewards people for doing the right things and punishes them for doing the wrong things, you control behavior and you and that really understanding how rewards work is all you really need to understand how people work. So I thought he was wrong, and I spent the early part of my career doing research and writing about what was wrong with his approach to human nature, to human behavior.
And what did you think was wrong?
Well, I think it's way too limited a view of what people care about. They care about more than rewards. You can create a world in which people operate only, to use the term that is currently popular, only transactionally. It's every interaction we have. The question is, what can I get from you? And what do I have to give in order to get that? People care about doing the right thing. They care about contributing to the well-being of others. They care about making the world a better place to live in. They care about close relations to other people. And all of that was absent from Skinner's, at least his scientific view, if not his personal one. So that's what was wrong with it. It's a piece of what people are like, but it's not all of what people are like. And I wrote a couple of books on that. But what I didn't know, partly because I had spent too much time studying psychology and not enough time studying other things, is that Skinner's view is remarkably compatible with the view of classical economics. And although in those days, people weren't really listening much to psychologists, they were certainly listening to economists. So I started reading economics and reading about the relation between psychology and economics. And that's what got me interested in studying decision making. But for the first 25 or so years of my career, I did experiments with pigeons and rats doing ridiculous things in little boxes to get food or water. I had no grandiose notions about how what I was doing related to human society. I was lucky enough to teach in a place that encouraged not specialization, but generalization. It is a small liberal arts college. I spent a lot of time talking to people outside of psychology. So in many respects, my education began after I started teaching, not before. If I'd been in a large university, my guess is that my career would have looked quite different.
How do you do your research?
Well, nowadays, I don't do much research. What I do is I write about other people's research. I try to write about it in a way that's accessible to popular audiences rather than just professionals. So I try to take jargon and turn it into English and then publish it so that the population at large knows what's going on and perhaps thinks differently about important things in their lives. The empirical research I'm still doing, I'm doing in collaboration with other people who have active labs and with their students. So I have several projects that are going on where I'm merely a participant in a larger group.
How do you organize the information that you gather, either from your own empirical research or when going through other people's research? I mean, how do you keep track of the information and keep order before presenting it to others?
Well, that's a real challenge. There's an explosion of information. I've never been a really compulsively comprehensive scholar, or organized. So, my interests wander, my mind wanders, I read things, I sort of bounce from one topic to another and one discipline to another. I try to keep track of what I'm reading and make notes about what I'm reading. But often things don't coalesce until somebody asks me to give a talk or to write a chapter or something, or I decide it's time to write a book. And then I sit down and try to keep it all organized. I'm not terribly efficient. At this stage, I'm 71 years old. I don't care anymore. I do what I'm interested in. And, when the time comes, hopefully I'm able to put it together and into something that's a coherent and compelling narrative. But when I wrote the book, the book that has gotten the most attention of all the things I've done, the book about how having too many choices can be paralyzing, I had this idea. And then I went out and started reading lots of different literatures to try to develop the idea. So the idea of the book came first, and then everything that ended up in the book came after I had decided that this is a book that needed to be written. And I really didn't know what direction it would go in when I started working, because I had so little advance knowledge of the various topics that I ended up writing about.
Okay, so it's like the desire or the idea or the goal triggers a great synthesis.
That's what happens in my case. Or let me not use the word great. A synthesis, an attempt to synthesize. That's correct.
All right. Let's go over and talk about your book, The Paradox of Choice. So the premise of the book is basically that we're told so many times, especially in the United States, where you're from, that more choice is better, and that's just inherent in American capitalism. But you seem to disagree with this. Why do you disagree?
The reason I disagree, and the reason I disagree is that the evidence suggests that it's not correct. here's the assumption that we have made as social scientists and as citizens in the democratic developed world is that since we know that choice is good for 100 reasons, if choice is good, more choice must be better. If a little bit of something is good, more of it must be better. And, you know, until the last 30 or 40 years, this assumption never really got tested. Societies weren't rich enough. Options weren't plentiful enough for us to test the assumption that if some choice is good, more is better. And the explosion, both of wealth and of choice opportunities that we've all experienced in the last 30 years, has shown us that you can reach a point where instead of being liberated by options, people are paralyzed by them. They can't make decisions. If they do make decisions, they make bad decisions because it's too complicated. And if they manage to make good decisions, they are dissatisfied with them because it's so easy to imagine that another option would have turned out better. I don't know that anyone could have anticipated this. It's very hard to see the other side of the mountain until you get to the top of the mountain. But I think now it's just abundantly clear. You see it, I think, in university students who can't figure out what to do with their lives after they graduate. So they just put their lives on hold, hoping that one morning they'll wake up knowing what they're meant to do with the rest of their lives. I think you see it in romantic relationships, thanks to Tinder and various other websites. You now, in some sense, can choose a romantic partner from thousands of possibilities. And I think what that does is it leads to intimate relationships where each partner is looking over the other one's shoulder in case somebody better comes along, which is not a great way to build an intimate life with somebody else. I think people are really just completely devastated by the wealth of options and no idea how to choose among them. And let me just say one other thing. This is a problem. This is a rich people's problem. This is not, you know, the majority of people in the world don't face this problem. But in the developed world, I think many people face this problem.
Do you think it's harder for young people now, let's say people like you were saying, who are attending college or haven't even begun to attend college or university? Do you think it's a harder situation, more cognitively demanding for them than when you first, back in the day when you were going to university?
There's just no question about it. When I was deciding where to go to college, there was almost no way to get information about different colleges. You'd send away for their catalogs and they would come, and the catalogs were really not meant for prospective students. They were meant for current students, and it was almost impossible to make sense of them. So for the most part, where the options that you thought about, or you got them from people a year or two older than you who had already gone through this process. So I didn't think about every school I might go to. I thought about a half a dozen schools and made decisions on the basis of ridiculously unimportant criteria as in the grand scheme of things, like where they're located or how good their athletic teams were, stuff like that. Nowadays, a poor high school junior can find out everything about every school on the planet. And so you have the sense, A, that there's a right answer to the question, where should I study? And B, you ought to be able to find that answer. And then you get to school and you face exactly the same thing when you have to decide what to study, what classes to take. I think it's a nightmare. And, you know, this notion that it's easy to gather and then evaluate the information is just a fantasy. It's not easy to evaluate information.
But could it be good for the brain to face a lot of choices and hard choices, even if it doesn't really make you happy? Could it maybe keep your brain young longer?
We don't know the answer to that. I think there are lots of ways to keep. First, let me just rephrase what you said, since I think I don't like using brain because there's this attitude around these days that when you use the word brain, you're being scientific, whereas when you use the word mind, who knows what the hell you're talking about? So I at least don't have any idea what the brain is doing. So let's say the mind. Can you keep your mind sharp by working hard at some cognitive task? Absolutely. But there are lots of cognitive tasks available that don't involve, I mean, going to the supermarket and seeing that there are 200 different breakfast cereals to choose from, there are better ways to exercise your mind than that. So yes, we should be active cognitively. And the more active we are, the more we can push away the prospect of dementia and Alzheimer's disease and stuff like that. But why don't we devote our time and energy to thinking about things that matter instead of thinking about things like what cereal to buy?
Right. Going back to the example of the high school students or young kids who face more choices, I think you can almost extrapolate that as a general example in society in general, in the sense that people are having more kind of trick choices or fake choices placed by advertising and clever salespeople, where they kind of bring up questions or make you question things that maybe isn't really a necessary question to ask from the beginning. But then you start thinking about it and you think it's a real option to think about or consider, like some maybe because they want to create a fake benefit for their university or their product or something. And then they trick you into thinking.
There's no question that that happens. And this connects to what we were talking about a little while ago about nudges. We seem to tolerate the efforts of advertisers to manipulate us and not to tolerate the efforts of government to manipulate us. You're absolutely right that what happens is that, you know, you make some product and your job is to convince people that they simply have to have that product. So you look at what makes your product different from other products on the market, and then you run this whole campaign trying to convince people that this thing, which is actually trivial, is the thing that everyone needs to have. I remember at some point, I think Apple came out with the desktops, as if anyone has a desktop anymore, that came in different colors. Now, who the hell cares what color your desktop computer is? But now all of a sudden, you can get them in 10 different colors from Apple, and now it becomes something you have to think about. You know, what matches the color of the paint on my wall or the color of my desk or what have you? What could be more trivial thing to spend time thinking about than that? But if they're good at what they do, they get us to think about it. And that's what marketers do, and they do it pretty well.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that, you know, as you become older or you become more well-read or like erudite and smarter, especially in the sense of pattern recognition, that you can kind of screen out the things that you know are tricks or, you know, different things like that. But when you're young, you don't have that mental filter developed yet.
Yeah, but I think we're overconfident about our ability to screen all this stuff out. It's kind of a game, it's almost like an arms race. You develop pattern recognition to screen stuff out, and the marketer knows that. And so the marketer comes up with a new approach that you don't have pattern recognition detectors for, to try to engage you. And you reach a point where you're sort of cocky. You know, I know how this game is played. I'm too smart to be influenced by marketers. Well, you know, if you have that thought, you're doomed because you aren't too smart to be manipulated by marketers.
Right. Yeah. How about if we talk about the opposite? In which areas of life do we seem to prefer more choice?
Well, so that's a complicated question. First of all, even though I think the evidence is clear that too much choice is bad for people, if you ask people, they always seem to want more choice. So the fact that people say they want more choice doesn't mean that they should want more choice. We've all sort of bought this ideology that freedom is the highest good and the way to enhance freedom is to enhance choice. So we always say yes to more options, often to our detriment. In my own view, there are areas where people need more choice. Most importantly, in my mind, people need more choice when it comes to political leadership, government leadership. The United States is a sort of a political disaster because people are forced to choose between two candidates. And that doesn't come close to capturing the range of value commitments that people have. So you need more than two in the world of politics. That's, to me, the most salient domain where we have insufficient choice. And that's not true in every society. But you can have too much choice in politics also. You know, when you've got I now live in California, which is a very democratic state, at least the part of it I live in. So Democrat is going to win the election, but there are 15 Democrats trying to be the candidate. So before the general election, there are primary elections, and you have to choose among 15 candidates. How much time do you think it takes to do a thorough evaluation of 15 people? It's just not possible. And so it ends up that you make choices, political choices, consequential choices, on the basis of trivial things, like who your friend is voting for, or who looks most commanding in a televised debate. So even here, while having one or two candidates is not enough, it doesn't follow that the more options are available to people in the political sphere, the better off they are. There can be too many options here too. Though mostly, in most societies, there are too few at the moment, I would say.
All right, that's very interesting. Speaking of that, do you have any opinion about Milton Friedman and his philosophy, the kind of libertarian philosophy? Because I think that kind of goes against some of the things that you're saying, in the sense that he was really for having more choice in every area of life.
Absolutely so. I think, to his credit, unlike most current actual politicians, he was consistent. He thought that the government's job is to maximize individual citizens' freedom to choose and to keep people safe from external threats. And so he opposed any effort on the part of government to restrict options to serve the citizens. You know, he would rather that you were free to choose and made terrible choices that ruined your life than that you were protected from making terrible choices that ruined your life. And he was consistent about that. But there's an interesting little anecdote about Friedman that's worth mentioning. He has, I don't know how many kids he had, but one of his kids, one of his daughters was living with a guy and they refused to get married. And this upset Friedman and his wife no end. And he asked her why they were not getting married. And she said, well, you know, if we get married, we'll be in a higher income tax bracket than if we don't get married. So we're living together, but we're not going to get married. And this drove him crazy. So he wrote a piece for a national magazine arguing that the tax code should be changed so that there's no penalty for people who get married. Because he wanted his daughter to marry the guy she was living. And so, you know, this consistency only goes so far. And then you discover that you actually care about certain traditions that restrict freedom. And then you start arguing for ways, things the government can do to maintain those traditions that restrict freedom. But you're absolutely right. And it doesn't, it should not be assumed that it's correct to restrict freedom in the interest of enhancing well-being. It's quite possible that there are people who can legitimately contend that we are better off as a society with people completely free to make choices, even if we know that many of those people will make choices that are disastrous for them. I don't subscribe to that view, but I certainly think it's not a crazy view for somebody to have.
Okay, so that's where you would say that you really contrast with, for example, Milton Friedman.
That's correct.
Okay. Can we talk about the two types of freedom? This is something that I hadn't read about before, but I read it in your book, The Paradox of Choice.
You got to remind me about what the two types of freedom I wrote about are.
Freedom from or freedom to?
Yes. So this is actually an old idea from a philosopher named Isaiah Berlin, who taught, spent his almost his whole career, I think, at Oxford University. So he calls a distinction between negative liberty and positive liberty. So most of us think of freedom, at least in the United States, as freedom from, freedom from being told what to do, freedom from having what you want to say restricted, freedom from the unjustified imposition of demands on you by the state or by other people. So you basically want to be protected from other people pushing you around and telling you what to do. Fine. It's important to be protected from those things. What's undiscussed is the what he called positive liberty, which is the freedom actually to live a meaningful, engaged, satisfying life. And what it takes for that freedom is you have to build in a set of character traits and a set of skills that will enable people to take advantage of the opportunities that are around them in society. And at least in the United States, we have largely neglected asking, what do we have to do as a society so that people can actually take advantage of what society has to offer? How do we develop people so that they can make the most of their freedom? So freedom, too, is the empowering of people so that options that exist in principle actually exist for them in practice as well. So he made that distinction. I think in the United States Bill of Rights is mostly a freedom from set of propositions, protecting us from being dominated by the powerful. But we really say very little about how you develop people's capacities and potentials. I think the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is much more focused on positive freedom than the U.S. Bill of Rights is. So, for example, I mean, just to be concrete, you don't see anything in the U.S. Constitution about people having the right to be educated. And there's no way you can exercise positive freedom if you're ignorant. And so if you were focused on positive freedom, you would insist that everyone has to be adequately educated so that they can take advantage of the opportunities that that they encounter in life. That ought to be in our Constitution. It's not. You know, it may be in our practices, although we do a remarkably bad job of educating a very large segment of our population. That would not be true if we were as focused on developing people's capacities as we are at protecting them from being controlled by others.
I think that lies at the foundation of becoming, you know, a well-adjusted and successful knowledge worker in today's society. And I mean, most of the jobs that are going to be created in the future are going to be knowledge worker type jobs. So I think that is a pretty important thing to know.
It's a very important thing to know. And you know, it's true of knowledge workers, but it isn't just that. You know, there are going to be a lot of people, at least I hope there are, employed providing services to other people. Skilled nursing. You know, the population in the developed world keeps getting older and older, and they're going to need more and more help. And it takes a certain kind of person to be good at providing that help. You know, you need to be empathetic. You need to understand the problems that the people you're trying to help are facing. You need to understand how to help them face those problems. That also requires the development of your capacities, but now not your, quote, intellectual capacities as much as your emotional capacities. And that also is something that we ought to be committed to as affluent societies. And as near as I can tell, we're not, at least not at the moment.
This is something that you talk about in your TED talk. I think it's called Loss of Wisdom, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is basically the topic that you bring forth there. And I think the example that you give is someone who's a janitor, and they only tell the janitor in the job description, you know, mop the floors, do this and this and this and this, but they don't tell them about the contextual things.
They don't tell them anything about about interacting with other people. Because that's not a janitor's job, right? A janitor interacts with things and cleans them. But the work that I talked about in that talk studied actual janitors in a major hospital and found that some of them actually thought that their real job was to do whatever was necessary to assist in the hospital's mission of curing the sick and easing suffering. And that meant cheering patients up. It meant being considerate to the people visiting those patients. Many of those people were in the hospital every day for weeks or months. They were disoriented, they were sad, and they could use a little cheering up and a little bit of consideration. And, you know, some janitors thought that that was as much a part of their job as emptying trash cans and mopping floors. And it was really quite something to hear them talk about what their job was and how hard it was to get good at it, and how much satisfaction they got out out of doing it well. Nobody gets satisfaction out of emptying trash cans, as far as I know. So, yes, I think we have underappreciated what I guess are sometimes called soft skills, the importance of soft skills in being effective in your job and in your life.
What are some examples of things that you wish you'd known, or maybe would like to give as advice to some of our younger listeners, say someone who is between 16 and 30?
There are a few things I learned over the course of my career that it would be useful to know in advance. I'm not sure that you can learn these things except by getting them wrong and suffering the way I did and the way most of us do. One thing I learned is no matter how smart you are, there's somebody smarter, which is another way of saying chances are pretty good that whatever you think about a situation is in some important way wrong. In other words, be humble. You have a lot to learn from a lot of people. And that's a very important lesson for people to bring with them into their interactions with other people. Second, there are worse things in life than making mistakes. This, by the way, is an extremely hard lesson to teach people since they kind of feel like the world is so precarious now that as soon as they get something wrong, their career is finished or their life is finished. We mostly learn how to do things right by doing them wrong and seeing what the consequences are. So we need to be courageous enough to take risks that may end in failure as long as we are clued in enough so that we'll learn from that failure. And if you're managing other people, you want to encourage them to feel that they can take a chance and fail because that's where the great new ideas and breakthroughs come from. So don't be afraid to fail and be humble about what you think you know. Those are the most important things that I learned.
Yeah, very interesting. It's very difficult to square all those things. Yeah, you have to be humble, but still courageous enough to act and then dare failing and not be even more humbled by that failure so you don't start again. Nevertheless, I think the US is doing a pretty good job at embracing failure and embracing serial entrepreneurs that actually keep failing, and that's more of a badge of honor. I think in Sweden, for example, I think we are at the very opposite end of the spectrum. We don't really dare to do anything here. And if you've failed, you know your place, that you shouldn't try again. And everybody else around you know that as well, and makes they make sure that you don't try again.
Yeah, I hear you, but I think the sort of romantic excitement of Silicon Valley gives the impression that this is the attitude of American culture at large, and it's not. I think most people in their work situations and in their life situations think there's no room for failure. There's this little tiny island that's been cut away, you know, where, yes, start a company and fail and learn your lesson and then start another company and fail and eventually you're Facebook. That is not the attitude that most people are covering their asses. They don't want to make mistakes. If they make mistakes, they don't want to admit that they made mistakes. And they live and work in an atmosphere where mistakes are not acceptable. So in that sense, I don't think our two countries are that different. Silicon Valley is something of an anomaly. And the only reason, by the way, I think it is the way it is that when you finally succeed, you make so much damn money that all the failures just disappear. Doesn't matter. You win the lottery when you succeed. And that's not true most of life. You know, if you're a doctor talking to a patient and giving a patient bad news, she has a terminal illness, there are a lot of ways to have that conversation that will be a disaster. But you have to have the conversation and you need to be mindful enough and humble enough that you may well get it wrong, so that you learn over time how to talk, how to have hard conversations with people about hard topics. The safe thing to do is simply to be sort of cut and dried and say, well, these are the facts of your case and these are your options, without worrying too much about how people will be affected by the news you're giving them. But that's a real disservice to your patients. So you have to make yourself vulnerable. You have to risk getting it wrong. And ultimately, you really get better and better at having these kinds of difficult conversations. It's true when doctors talk to patients, when lawyers talk to clients, when parents talk to their children, and when we talk to our romantic partners. others.
Do you have any particular thoughts at the cross section about the paradox of choice and what we've just talked about the being afraid to fail?
Yeah, I think these are two incompatible messages. You're perceptive enough to have seen it. you know, in the talk I gave about our loss of wisdom, a lot of what I have to say, and the talk was a 20-minute distillation of a book I wrote with a colleague. The way we respond socially, culturally to failures is we make rules that people have to follow so that those failures won't happen again. And you can't make adequate rules. You know, rules protect us from disaster, but they don't get us to do the right thing. They just prevent us from doing catastrophic things. So this is an argument against rules when you're interacting, particularly when you're interacting with people, whether they be students, children, patients, what have you. But if you're not going to use rules, it means you have to make choices. So it's an argument, in effect, that people should have more choice, not less, in figuring out how to interact with other people. And the paradox of choice is all about people should have less choice, not more. So I am saying incompatible things. But, you know, I think we have created a society in which people have too many choices about things that don't matter and not enough choices about things that do matter.
Okay.
So at least in my head, they're not incompatible.
Okay. In this talk, The Loss of Wisdom, you say this, and I quote you, a wise person, I was about to say a white person.
Yes.
A wise person knows how and why to make an exception to every rule. But I'm wondering, what does it take to gain wisdom?
Well, mostly what it takes is what I talked about a few minutes ago. You try, you're attentive to feedback about whether what you try worked. And when it didn't work, you try something different. So wisdom, you don't have to be old to be wise, but you do have to be experienced. And that means you have to try different ways to talk to your romantic partner or your kid or your student or your patient and find out way is the one that communicates what needs to be communicated. That influences behavior that needs to be influenced, that doesn't devastate. But mistakes are inevitable. You can minimize mistakes if you're mentored by somebody who's already gone through this process, who kind of puts up guardrails for you so you won't go too far astray. You know, we don't all have to learn from scratch completely on our own. So good mentoring, lots of feedback, and you grow progressively wiser in your interactions over the course of your experience. So I don't really think there are wise people. I think there are wise doctors who experience has taught how to interact with patients, and wise teachers, and, you know, wise parents. But because you're a wise doctor doesn't mean you're also wise in raising your own children. You have to learn specific skills in specific settings and be willing to, you know, to make big mistakes and then correct them to develop wisdom. It's a lot easier just to follow somebody else's rules.
I think what's underlying in what you're saying is that it is sort of domain specificity, which is a psychological effect. And how can we make this expertise or the thing that we learn, how can we make it general so that it applies to more than one situation?
I don't know the answer to that. You know, I think I am saying it's domain specific, but domains are not completely non-overlapping. So there are situations where your kid is vulnerable in the same way that a patient is vulnerable. So there'll be an overlap. How do you have a conversation with a vulnerable person when you have information that has to be communicated and the other person has to listen to something that will be painful to listen to? And maybe if you think about it in that way, your wisdom in talking to patients can be useful as you try to have a difficult conversation with your adolescent child. It's an empirical question how generalizable these skills are. But, you know, I start off with the assumption that it's pretty domain specific.
Right. Because I think one way to build a pretty solid career foundation when you're young is to try to do this and also try to learn different transferable skills so that you know that you could take different kinds of jobs or maybe change your career in case mm-hmm. that you didn't find what you liked from the beginning.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And, you know, in this book that we wrote about wisdom, we talk about some of the elements that wise people need. They need to be empathetic. They need to take the perspective of the people they're working with. They need to be willing to risk failure and various other things like that. And I you know, I think that if you have these attributes as a person, you will probably have what you're calling transferable skills. But there aren't any guarantees that what you learn will be easily and automatically transferable to another, to a different domain. There's a guy named Jeffrey Pfeffer who teaches at Stanford Business School who had wrote a book some years ago in which he had the insight that most employers hire people who have the skills that will make them useful to the company immediately. This, says Pfeffer, is a mistake. What companies should be doing is hiring on the basis of attributes they do not know how to teach, and then teaching what they do know how to teach. You know, so I can teach you how to do financial analysis. I can't teach you how to be honest. I can't teach you how to be dedicated. I can't teach you how to be empathetic, or at least I don't know how to teach you. I can teach you how to do financial analysis. So the trouble with this is that if you hire somebody who's got all these right character traits, this person is useless to you until you've taught the specific skills that are going to be needed in the job. And so what you're doing is you're spending money on salary and getting no return. Ultimately, of course, you'll get a big return. Pfeffer says this is really short-sighted on the part of employers because they hire people who can do financial analysis but are basically otherwise, you know, sort of human basket cases, which is not the right way to be making hiring decisions. So I kind of think that, you know, what the most transferable skills are virtues of character that will serve you well in any job you have, in any life situation you face. Honesty, integrity, perseverance, these things, they're gonna be good traits to have whatever job you do. And that's what we want to try to cultivate in our young people. And it's what you want to have as you enter job markets and you want to be able to point to when you're convincing people that you should be hired rather than somebody else.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty profound. So hire what you can't train, basically.
I think that's an incredibly, it just spun my head around. You know, once I read it, I said, well, of course, but it never occurred to me before I read it. And most companies don't practice it.
Okay. So let's wrap up with some future skill related questions.
Yeah.
And let's begin with trends. So what are some of the trends that you are seeing or have seen spring up as a response to this over choice in society? How does it make people react?
Well, it makes people withdraw. Mostly because they don't know how to cope. I think one response is you've seen the growth of these efforts to curate options. You know, you go to websites that rate restaurants or you have reviews of restaurants when you're trying to decide where to eat in a new city.
TripAdvisor.
Like TripAdvisor. You know, there are millions of them now. So the idea is I can't make this decision on my own, so I'm going to ask somebody. Well, who do you ask? You ask these anonymous people who you don't have any idea what matters to them, but it's better to have somebody's opinion than no opinion. And I think there's a sense people have that just as the digital world has created or magnified the problem of too much choice, it will also provide us with a solution. And, you know, maybe it will. It hasn't yet. I don't find these recommendation engines particularly helpful, although some are better than others. I'm a astonished at how accurately Netflix recommends movies that I might be interested in based on movies I've already seen. So you can do it in principle.
I think there are two ways to go on that. And the first is you have probably developed these filters in the sense that you know what criteria you're looking for. So you don't need that agent to make that choice for you.
Right.
But a lot of people probably don't, or they wouldn't be so successful financially. That's one thing. And the other thing I think is you mentioned this in the book. And I quote you, that we've developed all these amazing time-saving machines, but we don't know what to do with it. We don't know what to do with the free time because we don't have any real purpose.
Well, I think that's a separate problem. And it's interesting to me that even though we have developed all of these time-saving devices, people seem busier now than they ever were before. You know, I am astonished at how hard it is to arrange a dinner for three couples. You know, you have these friends, you'd like them to meet one another. So you say, let's all have dinner together at our house. And now you comes time to set a date. And you end up setting a date 2 months in the future, because there's no other date that all three couples, all six people are available. I mean, how can people be so busy when we've got all these devices that are saving us so much time? And I don't think this is just an American problem. I think that this is the way the rich world currently is. And so I think people are busy doing a lot of things they probably shouldn't be doing. And the reason is they're flailing around. This gets back to your question about purpose. People flail around because they don't really know what's more important than what they should be focused on, what really matters to them, what matters to the world. So they just flail around. They bump into stuff in the world that looks attractive, and then they pursue it, and all of a sudden their life is filled up with these obligations and commitments that are essentially pointless. Yes, we have labor-saving and time-saving devices that don't seem to have saved us much, either in the way of labor or time.
What is your take on social media? Do you use it?
No. I thought it was frivolous. I didn't have anything against it. I thought it was sort of benign but frivolous. And life is complicated enough, so I didn't use it. And now it's turned out it's not benign. It's actually fairly malignant, or can be, unless controls get put into place. So I just haven't used it. I've watched my grandchildren go nuts with social media, which helps convince me that I made a good decision to stay away from it. I have a Facebook page that I never look at, and I have a Twitter account, and I've tweeted 4 times in 15 years. So I can't say I don't use social media. All I can say is I use social media less than anybody on earth who has Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts.
Would you go as far as to say that social media is one of your greatest concerns about the future, or do you have other horsemen?
I think it's a real concern because it has misdirected people. People think online relationships are equivalent to face-to-face relationships. They're not, and this is a mistake, and they put too much of their time and effort into developing the online. But I would say, you know, aside from the lunatic who is currently the president of the United States and the most powerful person on earth, my pressing concern has to do with what kind of work people will have to do as machines get better and better at doing the knowledge work that a lot of people currently do. We need to find ways to make sure that people can do work that's meaningful to them and engaging to them and gets them a living. And I don't think there's any society that has thought nearly carefully enough about that problem. And that's a problem we'll be facing probably in a generation at most. I mean, we're already facing it, but it will only get worse. So aside from Trump blowing up the world, that's my biggest long-range concern.
Okay, you mentioned perhaps controls should be put in place on social media. Could you explain what you mean there?
You know, I think we need to have procedures that keep that make it harder for people to proliferate ridiculous lies about what's going on in the world. And we need to have controls in place that prevent make it hard for people to encounter machine-produced content that they think is person-produced content. Those are my current concerns, just because of what's surfaced in the last little while. Who knows what the next set of problems will be? It's interesting, you know, when the Arab Spring happened and these spontaneous protests were organized via Twitter, people thought this was the people's revolution. The digital revolution was going to empower people. It turned out that this was a promise unfulfilled, because what happened is that it became easy to organize a demonstration. In the old days, you actually had to put effort into building organizations so that when something came up, what you wanted to have a demonstration about, you could contact the organizations and the organizations could contact their members and you could get 10,000 people or whatever together at a particular time and in a particular place. Now all you have to do is send a tweet, hope it goes viral, and you've got a demonstration. But the problem is that the nice thing about it being hard to get people together to demonstrate is that it forces you to build organizations. And because it became easy to get people together to demonstrate, demonstrate, no effort has gone into building organizations. And the result is that you have a demonstration and 10 minutes later, it's over. And there's nothing, has nothing to show for itself. So this is my concern with social media generally. It's a lot of flash with very little of substance to show for itself when the dust settles. Is this inevitable? Who knows? This is just the way things are now. I guess you could make them better.
On the flip side of these concerns, what is something that makes you really optimistic about the future?
I think young people are, at least in the U.S., much more concerned about spending their lives doing something that will make the world better and not simply make their bank account bigger. And that, to me, is a source of real optimism. That makes me feel good about the future.
Okay, thanks for listening, and I hope that you learned something useful from our conversation with Professor Barry Schwartz. I'd also like to recommend that you listen to episode 4, where we cover an idea from his book, Paradox of Choice. And in this episode, we talk about whether you're a maximizer or a satisficer. And the big takeaway is that if you are a maximizer, kind of like a perfectionist, then it becomes more important for you that you choose the right projects to work on and that you have clear criteria for what you do. Otherwise, you might end up doing pretty much nothing at all. Whereas someone who's a satisficer generally does not have this problem. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter if you want to receive weekly summaries of the episodes. And you can find this at www.futureskillspodcast.com or by going into the link in the bottom of the description. Okay, until next time.